Okay, so then just to say a little bit more about the Mahayana, because there's this whole, debate about what are the origins of the Mahayana. And at least for the Prajnaparamita, they say, that the Buddha taught it was taken to the land of the Nagas, and then Nagarjuna brought it back. He lived in the 2nd century A.D., late 1st, early 2nd century A.D., although the Tibetans say he lived 600 years. There could have been many Nagarjunas. Okay, so there's that. But then in other Mahayana sutras, it will say, thus I've heard the Lord was at, some other place. Instead of being in Rajgir, he was at Shravasti. And he spoke some sutra. In fact, I think the Gandavuha Sutra was spoken at Shravasti. Can't remember exactly, but I think. And that's a Mahayana sutra. So, and yet you have the sutras of, they start off in Shravasti and they wind up in, you go to, this universe over here and then this solar system and back to that one over there. There's so much more expansive. Yeah, and you don't get the feeling of the Buddha as a historical person so much, but much more of a cosmic feeling. So, there seem to be a lot of views. Some people will just say, these were made up. Okay, there were people who just made these up. They wrote them down. They said they were the words of the Buddha, and that's it. Okay. And some people, if you go to any of these conferences with different Buddhist traditions, some people say that. They'll just say it was all made up. None of it's the word of the Buddha. But then it seems like there's a few other alternatives for how these could have appeared. Okay? So one alternative is this ancient Tibetan one of, the Buddha spoke it, and then because the disciples weren't ready, it was taken to another place, and then it was brought back, okay? Or it was stored in a forest, or in the land of the Nagas, or with certain beings, or in a rock, kind of like the what later became the Terma tradition in Tibet, except here it was the Buddha reciting something, and then it was later, the text was later found somewhere else, hidden somewhere in nature, and recuperated that way. So that's one way that it could have happened. Okay? Another way is that, people were doing very intense meditation, and in their meditation, they had visions. And they had visions of the Buddha, and the Buddha spoke a sutra to a certain holy being in their meditation, and, that meditator wrote the sutra down afterwards, and that could have become one of the Mahayana sutras, okay, that came through the power of this person's, meditative vision, or perhaps, in their dreams. They had a very strong dream, and the Buddha spoke to them, and they wrote it down afterwards, and that became one of the sutras. Then another way it could have happened is that the Buddha blessed or inspired certain people's speech. And so when they spoke, it was considered the Buddha's word, even though it was somebody else speaking. So if you look at the Heart Sutra, for example, okay, the only thing the Buddha said happens at the very end, where he says, very good, very good, Shariputra, Avalokiteshvara, what you said is spot on. Yeah, that's the only thing the Buddha said. The actual sutra was spoken by Avalokiteshvara, and it was kind of set up by Shariputra. You know, so another interpretation could be that the Buddha inspired the minds of Shariputra and Avalokiteshvara so that they had this kind of dialogue. Yeah, and then there was an audience who witnessed it, and somebody heard it and wrote it down. Okay, so you know there's various other ways to account for the origin of the Mahayana sutras, different ways that they could have come into existence in this way. And I was reading one article because it seems like you know, a lot of the scholars, and actually some of the practitioners, I hear this too when I go to conferences, is they seem like to think like way back when there was this big difference between the scholars who did the recitation and taught, and they were the monastics in the monasteries, and then the people who were actually meditators who actualized the teachings. Okay, and some people, some historians look at this and they present it as if these are two very different groups of people. You know, you were a monastic, you stayed in the monastery, you were one of these bhanakas who, you know, learned the things by heart and recited it and gave commentary, and you may or may not have practiced because you were so busy learning and reciting the sutras. And then there were the meditators who, you know, kind of pushed aside all this scholastic study to really just meditate. And, you know, so there's this view, yeah, that you see sometimes. And I wonder where it came from. You know, even in the Tibetan tradition, you see this, and you see this kind of prejudice going on right now in the Tibetan traditions. You know, the Gelugpas are just the ones who study, and the Nyingmas and Kagyus, they meditate. Okay? And in fact, I remember one time I gave a talk at a Kagyu center in North Carolina, and somebody came up to me afterwards and said, that really blew my mind, because, you know, she gave me the label Galupa. She said, you're Galupa? But you could not have given that talk if you didn't meditate. You know? I mean, she had just heard this standard thing that the Galupas just know blah, 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 and the Kagyus are the one who meditate. And she said, oh, you practice. Well, duh. You know? So, I mean, there's this... And then you have... you know, so sometimes you have, like, different schools getting a little bit uppity, you know? And what I've seen recently, there was an ad in Snow Lion. I forget, one Western practitioner has gone back and translated a whole bunch of the Kagyu scholastic work and commentaries on some of the Indian treatises, because he thought that everybody said, well, thought that the Kagyus never studied, all they did was meditated, and he wanted to show that the Kagyus did study. You know, so there's all these kind of weird stereotypes, and the Westerners fall into it, but we fall into it because it exists in the Tibetan community. We would not have dreamt these things up just ourselves. But so there's all these kinds of weird stereotypes. And you see them, like, even when they tell the story of Milarepa, and Milarepa is certainly many, many centuries after the time that I'm talking about here, maybe 1,000 centuries afterwards. But, 100. No.
1,000 years?
1,000 years. That's 10 centuries, isn't it? Okay, so 10 centuries after the period I'm talking about. But, you know, you'll have these stories of how Milarepa had a dialogue with some arrogant Geshe, you know, and this Geshe would know blah, blah, blah. And this Geshe, this was before the Galupas even existed, so you couldn't even say they were Galupa. You know, but some scholar who knew blah, 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 and then Milarepa would, like, just humiliate this guy because the guy knew a lot of stuff, but he never practiced and never tamed his mind. Okay? So Milarepa may say, well, I don't know all these categories, but at least, you know, my mind's full of bliss and emptiness, and your mind isn't, you know? And so, you know, I think it's very easy. You read this, And then you form a stereotype in your own mind. Oh, well, Milarepa just scorned study, you know, and he never studied. He scorned it, and all he did was meditate. But that's not true. You know, Milarepa must have studied. He must have. I mean, he stayed there with Marpa for quite a while. If he wasn't studying, I mean, besides carrying rocks, you know, what he must have, he went to Marpa for a reason. You go to a guru for a reason, you know, it's to learn from the guru. So he must have done some study in there. But we forget that this story of Marpa and the Geshe, it's told for specific individuals who might tend to become arrogant because they know a lot. And so it's a kind of warning for those individuals not to get arrogant and think that you have realizations just because you have a lot of stuff memorized and you know a bunch of lists. But that's the reason he told it. He wasn't saying that everybody who did any kind of study, all they were academics and didn't know any meditation. He wasn't saying that. But we make these categories and stereotypes, okay, which I don't think are necessarily so accurate. I mean, even if you look at Naropa, you know, Naropa was abbot of Nalanda. Naropa had studied for years and years and years. Now, it's true, as the story goes, that Vajrayogini appeared to him in the form of this old hag and said, Naropa, you don't know anything. You know all this stuff and you think you're a hotshot abbot of Nalanda. You don't know anything. Look at the state of your mind. It's a mess. Okay. And then from there, you know, that's when Naropa left Nalanda and he started, you know, wandering around and eventually he found Talopa. He wound up disrobing and he found Talopa and, you know, then started practicing Vajrayana and eventually attained realizations through this. But you look at it, Naropa didn't come into Vajrayana cold, not knowing anything. Okay? And I wonder if his knowledge was just completely a bunch of categories and numbers and recitations. Yeah? I mean, does somebody really become abbot of Nalanda because they just have a bunch of words memorized? You know, and they're a good debater. I think you must need some kind of internal spiritual cultivation, you know, because the rest of the monks there aren't going to respect somebody whose behavior is totally bananas. And unless you've tamed your mind somewhat, that's how your behavior is going to be. So, you know, Naropa must have been doing some practice, you know. And plus, his ability to gain realizations through the Vajrayana, I think, must have been founded on his having studied so many scriptures beforehand because he understood, you know, what's the measure of having attained renunciation, how to develop bodhicitta, what's the correct view of emptiness, you know? I mean, he had those understandings from the study that he had done. So it wasn't just like he, you know, Joe Blow off the street comes in and takes Vajrayana initiation and, you know, his teacher, you know, pees on some sand and hits him in the face and he becomes a Buddha. You know, I don't think it's quite that simple. Yeah. So what I'm getting at is it's so easy to read these things and take them out of context and form false opinions, and then they become stereotypes of other traditions. That's what I'm getting at, okay? Is that I don't think that that's completely fair to do that. Okay, so anyway, back 10 centuries to the time we're talking about. You know, it seems like some of the scholars, even when studying Buddhism in those early AD years, had the same, and BC years, had this thing of, you know, dividing the scholars from the meditators, because they said, okay, well, in the early years before the canon was written down, everybody learned just for the purpose of meditation. But then after the canon was written down, and after you had the formation of these monastic universities and the threat from the Hindus, then they started learning in order to defeat the Hindus, you know, and do all of that. And so then the purpose of learning changed. So, I don't know, maybe that's true. Maybe for some people, you know, they getting a good education through becoming a monastic. You know, they were scholarly like type people and they did it. You know, maybe for some of them that was how it did. But I don't think you could say that that was true for everybody in those monastic universities. No, because if you look at the treatises they wrote, I mean, you can't write that kind of thing unless you do some practice. No way, you know. Anyway, this one Western scholar, he also had this kind of doubt about, you know, the meditators and the scholars being completely separate, because he was saying, like he was talking about Shantideva's Shiksa Samucha, and how Shantideva was recommending that people, when they practice, recite certain sutras. Okay? So he was saying, look, you know, here's a meditator who's doing a lot of meditation, but he's also doing recitation of sutras. Yeah? So he really questioned this split, and he was saying, no, he thinks that there's a lot of meditators who are doing recitation a lot of the time, and in your break time, reciting sutras. And actually, you know, in the oral instructions I received from my teacher, that's one of the things you're told to do in the break time of your retreat, is to recite sutras. Yeah. So then this Western scholar was saying that, okay, well, let's say you're reciting sutras a lot and you're meditating. Okay. What's going to happen? There's going to be some blend of what's going on here. And so he had the hypothesis that maybe if you recite something, then when you enter meditative equipoise, or you develop different samadhis, then maybe the Buddha appears to you in a vision. And because you've been contemplating a certain point a lot, because you've been reciting it in a sutra, then the Buddha gives you more explanation on that. And then that was written down and, you know, became known as one of the Mahayana sutras. Or maybe you dreamt about it at night and more was added to it, you know, because it was there in such a subtle level of consciousness. So that was one of his hypotheses about maybe how some of the Mahayana sutras came into being. Anyway, if they came out of somebody's meditative experience who had realizations, good enough for me. But I just think it's interesting how I think it's interesting how people can get very tangled up in all of this. Yeah, and when actually it comes down to our own practice, yeah, I mean, the real thing comes down to our own practice, doesn't it?